This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane. Eve Trout Powell was spending time with a Sudanese friend in Cairo a number of years ago and noticed that Egyptians referred to her friend as Abid, which means slave. That sparked her curiosity about the history of the relationship between these two countries and the slave trade in North Africa at the end of the 19th century. That's the subject of her new book, Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. Eve Trout Powell teaches the history of the modern Middle East as an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Among other honors, in 2003, she was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow and used some of her award to fund this research for this book. And Eve Trout Powell joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure, Marty. It's a pleasure.
Your book is titled Tell This in My Memory. Where does that come from?
It's a rough translation of a sentence that I read in a French article about St. Josephine Bajita, who was one of the people about whom I'm writing. And the phrase, if I can remember correctly, was raconte ça en ma mémoire, something quite like that. And I thought that would be a nice way of sort of tying the whole story together about preserving the memories of slavery and the experience of these slaves, these former slaves.
We're on the radio here, but the cover illustration of your book is very provocative. It's women, some sitting on what looks like a sidewalk, some look asleep. There's a woman holding a baby.
Right.
Where does this image come from?
This is from Jean-Louis Jérôme, the very famous Orientalist painter, who actually traveled to Cairo and to Istanbul in the 19th century. And I chose this picture. His work centers on slavery quite a bit, and for good reasons and for not helpful reasons. But I liked the picture of the mother and the baby. And I wanted to have some kind of picture of people talking to each other.
Yeah.
But actually, this painter has inspired me to, my next book will be about the visual culture of slavery.
What's almost in the shadow is a man.
That's right.
I mean, we almost don't see him.
Yeah.
But there he is with, I guess, his slaves.
Or I think the title of this is one version of Jérôme's many slave markets. And I think this one is at the Cincinnati Art Museum, and this is a slave market. So that moment of what was talked about in the slave market.
Tell us about this experience with your Sudanese friend where you hear this word Abid.
Okay. So this experience was in 92, so quite a while ago. But my friend, whose name is Yar, was from the south of Sudan, and she's from the Dinka tribe. And we were exchanging, at that time, her status, she had been a student at Cairo University. Her status had devolved because of the changing relations between Egypt and Sudan and the civil war in Sudan. And so, but we had a long history of trading English for Arabic lessons because her Arabic was fantastic and she was very helpful. So I would go meet her at Cairo University. And in Cairo, you share taxis. And we were waiting for a taxi and we got in on either sides of the taxi. So I'm not sure if the driver knew that we were actually together. And he turned to me with the assumption that I was Egyptian and said, "It smells like a slave in here." And I wasn't sure I had heard him correctly because I was studying Arabic, and this was, it hit me in my heart. But when I looked at Yar, she just unleashed this torrent of insults back at this cab driver. We got out of the cab. And then I began asking her about what it meant. And I said, would you say that was the equivalent of nigger, which was not a term she was familiar with, but it doesn't quite touch. It's got a different sting to it. And I do want to say that, this is not all Egyptians. This is not the experience of all Sudanese, but in Egypt. But there's a particular history and insult to this word that, with the many refugees with whom I spoke afterwards, they repeatedly said, this gets hurled at us.
And would you say then loosely translates into slave?
It loosely translates into a dark-skinned slave, an African slave, because in the systems of slavery throughout the Ottoman Empire and in Egypt, there were different slave trade networks. There were networks that reached all the way across to the Caucasus, to the Balkans, and of course to Sudan and to other parts of East Africa. So Abid has it's an African slave. That's the connotation.
And is your friend dark-skinned?
She is, yes, yes. She's actually also worked as a model. She's stunning. I mean, she also, but yes, and we have been friends for a very long time, and this would happen to her, you know, often enough that it was something you couldn't ignore it.
Well, clearly you couldn't ignore it because right. That really took you into this research and I guess literally into these dusty archives to find out about these slave narratives. Slaveholders and slaves themselves?
You know, the archives were not so helpful for the narratives of the slaves. And the archives that I was able to find narratives of the slaves themselves were not so dusty. Two of the most, fertile places for these narratives were the headquarters of the Canossian Daughters of Charity, which is a convent. And they're all over the world, but their headquarters are in Rome. This was Josephine Bajita's order. And the Comboni archive of now Saint Daniele Comboni, who was a missionary, a Catholic missionary, in the Sudan in the 19th century. Also, those headquarters are in Rome. But it's hard to find narratives in archives, which is why I reached out to look for narratives as well among slave owners who tended to write their experiences down in a very different way.
Well, let me ask you about Josephine Bajita, someone that actually you write about at the end of your book. And she's a former Sudanese slave. There's a picture of her praying. I guess she became a nun.
Yeah.
And she is a saint or is on her way to sainthood?
Canonized in 2000. Okay. Yes, she is a saint. Yeah.
She has a description here, and I have to say it's really... It's unnerving, a description of something that happened to her while she was, I guess, a slave.
Right. Okay. This description is, she told this to a sister nun, and it was written in Italian, and this is the translation of Bajita's experience of being scarred. When the girl was taken away, I was to be put in her place, but I couldn't move. After a harsh look from my master's wife, with her whip in hand, I immediately lay down on the mat. My mistress told the Arab woman to spare my face, but instead carved 6 cuts on my breast. With her tool, she began to give me 6 wide cuts on my breast, whose scars I still have today. Then followed the 70 cuts on my stomach, and finally the 48 on my right arm. I felt like I was about to die at every moment, especially when she rubbed the salt on me. Immersed in a lake of my own blood, I was then carried away on the mat, and afterward I blacked out. When I regained my senses, I saw that some of the slaves surrounded me, who were touched and even suffering on account of my suffering. For more than a month, all 3 of us were forced to lie on mats without being able to move, except to reach the rag that we used to dry the water that continually oozed from our wounds.
As I said, just a very chilling description. Was that common, this idea of scarring a slave, maybe with some identity of some sort?
You know, there are in other narratives of other former slaves who were enslaved in Sudan in the 19th century, there are other examples of this kind of cutting and scarring. But we should remember that this is also very much a part of a Christian narrative. And Bajita's body symbolizes a certain kind of suffering, and there's a way that this scene is used to completely desexualize her, right, as a Christian, and as a nun, and as a woman religious, but also to show, to highlight the suffering that she went through. So there's a lot, that piece does a lot of work changing her body, you know, from property or from this idea, very popular in the late 19th century, of highly sexualized African women into a Christian that 19th century Italian Catholics could understand.
And perhaps her suffering like the suffering of Jesus.
That's right, right.
And the idea of having your body scarred.
That's right, that's right. And her narrative was very much, I mean, after she died in 1947, immediately plans for her deification began and her beatification. And so there's a lot of work going on in that narrative.
So in terms of understanding, I guess, slavery, this part of the world, I won't say pipeline exactly, between Sudan and Egypt, but nonetheless, and of course the Ottoman Empire on top of that, her story is an important one, Joseph Bakhita?
I think it is. It's important because it's still used, and that's why it's important. So in Cairo, there are a lot of churches in Cairo, and there are a lot of refugees in Cairo, and refugees know when that if there is a church with Bakhita's face on it someplace on the door, all right, that's a place of sanctuary. And so she is evoked constantly. I mean, I interviewed a lot of refugees in a St. Bakhita center in this cathedral in Abbasiyah, this neighborhood of Cairo. So she's present. I mean, she's historically right there. She's there. And so...
Your book begins with a group of Sudanese refugees that set up a makeshift camp in the middle of Cairo.
Right, right. So this was in the fall of 2005, in the late fall. They set up a camp right across from the offices of the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, and for 3 months they were in Mustafa Mahmoud Square, and there's a beautiful huge mosque behind where they were, and for 3 months they were okay, but this kind of shanty town grew and grew. The officials in the mosque actually helped the refugees, and there was a lot of sympathy. But Mohandaseen is, as I wrote, a very bustling, very busy neighborhood, and especially where they were. And with no movement in sight, the UNHCR didn't respond to their pleas. Mm-hmm. The Egyptian government didn't understand what to do. And December 31st, 2005, the police attacked, came in and raided this little shanty town. And I believe 26, 27 people were killed, some of them children. Water cannons were used. And it shocked everybody. It shocked. It was on the front page of the New York Times the next day, New Year's Day. It shocked people, and it shocked people in Egypt as well. Why were they there? Why were they protesting? And why did they keep saying they were tired of being called Abid?
Abid, yeah, yes, right. Exactly. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Eve Trout Powell, and we're talking about her new book. It's called Tell This in My Memory, and it's subtitled Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. And she's a professor an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, teaches the history of the modern Middle East. She spent a lot of her time going back and forth between the United States and Egypt, and she's written a number of other books as well. And she was awarded a MacArthur Genius Foundation Fellow Award back in 2003. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY. Zollner Arts Center presents Mountain Heart this Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. for one show only. Mountain Heart combines bluegrass with rock, country, blues, and jazz, and brings their own style of excitement and energy to live performances. Tickets and more information are available at 610-7LU Arts or online at zollnerartscenter.org.
I'm Marty Moscowain, and I'm here to remind you about the important role that you play as a supporter to WHYY and to Radio Times. We're thrilled you listen to the show and the station. Now take that next step and become a supporter. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. And you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Where does your money go? Well, it gets invested in the interviews that you listen to on Radio Times. Today, we're getting two perspectives on overhauling the country's immigration system after President Obama's speech yesterday with two law professors from Temple University. And Eve Trout Powell, who teaches history at the University of Pennsylvania, is our guest to discuss her new book, Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. Here's that phone number, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org. Thanks so much for that pledge. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking with Eve Trout Powell about her new book called Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. And again, she's an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. The kind of slavery that you're writing about, and of course this is more than 100 years ago, but and in a different part of the world from the United States, is a very different kind of slavery than we had in this country. How would you describe it?
Well, first of all, it was multiracial slavery. Not that there wasn't multiracial slavery going on here in the United States, but what I mean is that there were white slaves coming from the Caucasus, coming from the Balkans. There were military slaves also coming from the Caucasus and the Balkans. And there were African slaves who were also military slaves. And there were African domestic slaves. In the Ottoman Empire, slavery could be a means of upward mobility. In the there was a system that began in the 15th, 16th centuries in which a system was set up called the devshirme, in which children from the Balkans were levied, and the most talented ones would join the strongest ones would join the Janissaries, the great army of the Ottomans. But others who were found to be very intelligent and very quick would be trained to become bureaucrats, which was an honor, which was a great thing to be then. And so you could rise as high as the vizier to the sultan and be
a
former slave, right, who could buy slaves too. And so it was a very different kind of identity than what developed here in the United States or, say, in the Caribbean.
So what did it mean then to be a slave? I mean, if you could rise in status and perhaps power, what did slavery mean?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer quickly. I'm teaching a course about this, and we're trying to in this graduate seminar, trying to unpack how different slave meant to different people in different parts of the system. So say you were a concubine in the royal palace of the Ottoman Sultan in the 19th century. Being a slave meant, you know, you were there perhaps for entertainment. It wasn't, you know, some were there to clean the house. Some were there. Others were there, you know, with great access to politics and stuff like that. It really depended where you were, you know. If you were manumitted, you could also buy slaves. And so it's the word itself does us no just – it doesn't help as much. We have to look at the process and where people were.
And I admitted to you during the break that when you remove race from the configuration of
right.
slavery – and perhaps I'm just too American. I don't even exactly know how to think about it.
Well, I have a feeling about this that I'm not sure I proved, but I'm not sure. We look at race very differently in this country. We're not even sure how we look at it,
yeah.
but we look at it very yeah. differently here. There is not a similar kind of discourse going on in the Middle East about race. It's very different. I think that legacies of slavery help us discover how we look at race all over the world. I think that is a generalization that I will stand by. But where do those identifications come from? So I think that, for instance, abid and who could be enslaved and just the meaning of that word came from slave markets in Sudan. Mm. I think that this is something that came, you know, that these ideas came from parts of the Caucasus and sort of the Ottoman system sort of internalized all of this. But there's still distinctions right. being made about who could be enslaved and who could not be. And they became racialized and took on a different meaning over centuries.
Well, and it's interesting, as you said, it was about 20 years ago, you're in a cab with a friend
right.
and she's called Abid, and it's not a compliment by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
It's an insult,
right.
I guess.
Right. And she took it as a racial insult.
Right.
And so did I, because she did too, you know. When I asked other people about this, though, when I asked, you know, many Egyptian friends about it, and some people were very open and said, yes, you know, it's definitely a problem. And mm-hmm. others said, no, it's a joke. It's not meant to be like that. And others felt, because I was an American, that I was imposing my sense of race. And that is something that I always worry about, because it's true that we have a very, very pervasive and deep idea, you know, of what race is, and that does not necessarily translate, but that doesn't mean that noticing it someplace else, you know, is wrong either.
Sure. Right. But slavery is about ownership, isn't it? I mean, bottom line, it's someone buys or owns somebody else.
Right.
And they are under their control to some degree.
Right. But what that control is and what kind of work they're being asked to do, or what kind of access does that give them, is where these mm-hmm. systems of slavery are much more complicated than the perhaps overly simplified view we have mm-hmm. of, you know, plantation slavery.
You tell another story about another person of religious persuasion, mm-hmm. a Father Daniel Sorer.
Right.
Who was a slave.
Right, right.
What's his story?
Oh, he has.
And there's a beautiful photo of him in here, I have to say.
I found that in the Kamboni archive. So unlike St. Josephine Bahita, with her great wingspan of faith, she was not a terribly eloquent person and never really mastered a certain kind of standard Italian. But Father Daniel Sorer Farim Deng was a former slave who was actually liberated by this great missionary, Daniele Camboni. Mm. And his linguistic gifts were discovered very soon. He was educated in Arabic in Cairo and then went to Rome, where he studied Italian. And I believe he was fluent in Arabic, Italian, French, German, in addition to his own indigenous language, which he did not forget. And he is sort of sent around on the abolition circuit of that the Vatican supported. And he's so powerful because he actually talks about the experience of other slaves, and his narrative is completely different
Wow.
than most other slaves. But the fact that he was able to do this in any language asked of him shows a certain eloquence. And he was also very sensitive to European racism and very, very sensitive to how he represented, what he represented as an African Christian man.
There's a very sad, I guess, story about him and his mother.
Yeah.
Sad, as a matter of fact.
This is unlike anything I've ever seen in any narrative, but he was enslaved with his mother. They were not separated, as happens in almost all of the other narratives I've seen. And then he ran away, and the mother was – and he ran away, but he wasn't far. The parish where he was, where he had escaped to, wasn't far from his master's house, and his master kept coming back to try to get him back. And then the owner brought his mom, and his mom begged him to come, and he refused. He asked her to join him, and she couldn't. Mm-hmm. And then the passage ends with her cursing him, or he thinks that she's cursing him, and that's how, and he never sees her again.
Wow. And she, for a while, sort of cleverly protected him, I guess, pretending that that he wasn't her son.
That's right.
Because then she was afraid she would lose him,
to
slavery.
That's right. But she lost him to liberation. But she's a mystery. I don't think, mm-hmm. I hope she didn't curse him. I hope that she blessed him. But what a moment of.
Yeah. And these stories of slaves, you found through what missionaries who had either liberated some of them or had interviewed some of them, talked to some of them, knew them?
Right. So, yeah, almost all of these, with the exception of Daniel Surafuddin Deng, almost all of these are as told to stories.
Right.
Salim C. Wilson is one who wrote his own narrative, but it was highly edited. And I have to say, this is something that made many others of my colleagues in Middle East history nervous, this idea of looking at narratives, because they were all filtered through missionaries, and there's such intense anti-Islamic sentiment in these and such intense anti-Arab sentiment in these that people have – historians of slavery in the Middle East have been very hesitant to touch on these, which is why I wanted to broaden the picture by looking at the narratives of those who owned slaves, who could perhaps – balance, if you will, the picture of sort of what that experience was. I grant the narratives more. I think that you can, if you filter them, if you think about it and read between the lines, you learn a great deal as well. But I do understand that hesitancy on the part of many of my colleagues.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Eve Trout Powell, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her new book called Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. And she is an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, teaches a courses on the modern Middle East. And her book, a very provocative book, I should have to say, and I learned a few things reading it. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Wonder if you could read another section from your book. And this is Taib Salih, Season of Migration to the North.
Taib Saleh is the is one of the great writers of Sudan, and one of the great writers in Arabic, and this classic, Season of Migration to the North, was published in Arabic, I believe, in 1967. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, Taib Saleh's way of honoring what happened to slaves. So this is a section from his novel. My grandfather used the edge of his gown to wipe away the tears that had run down his face from laughing so much, and after giving me time to settle myself into the gathering, said, "By God, that's some story of yours, Wadirayas." This was a cue to Wadirayas to continue the story my entrance had interrupted. And afterwards, Haj Ahmed, I put the girl in front of me on the donkey, squirming and twisting. Then I forcibly stripped her of all her clothes till she was as naked as the day her mother bore her. She was a young slave who just reached puberty. Her breasts, Haj Ahmed, stuck out like pistols, and your arms wouldn't meet round her buttocks. She had been rubbed all over with oil so that her skin glistened in the moonlight and her perfume turned one giddy. Her weeping would be made the subject of one of Wad Rais's famous stories about his many women with which he regales the men of the village. The rage in my breast grew more savage. Unable to remain, I left. Behind me, I heard my grandfather calling, but I did not turn around.
Mm. And why is that important?
Well, I think it's important because I think it shows a prominent Sudanese Arab writer very poignantly creating a character who is the conscience of Sudan, looking at how a story of enslavement is being told as a joke, and leaving the reader wondering about how could someone tell this kind of story, and how do you break that communal sense of humor about something that was obviously a real trauma to the girl mentioned in here.
As I said, it's hard not to think of our own system of slavery reading a book like this. But obviously there are differences. There are some similarities and commonalities as well. Mm-hmm. How do you think about our own system of slavery as you dig so deep into the research in this part of the world?
You know, I'm evolving. But one of the things that I have been thinking about is the idea of liberation and freedom, which is very different here and has always been very different here than from what it was for these slaves in the Middle East. So there was no Great Emancipation Day. There was no civil war about this, at least not in Egypt. I would say that perhaps in Sudan, the legacy of slavery is very much a part of the civil war and the independence of the new South Sudan. But so I've been really wrestling with that difference. One of the things that I would say is similar is the sexual vulnerability of women. Within the system of slavery. That I see as something that was shared across. What's very different is miscegenation was not a scandal in the Middle East, that it was possible for a woman who was a slave of a master to have a child. And the fathers often recognized these children, and these children would be born free, and the mother would be known as Umm al-Walad, or the mother of the child. And these women were often freed themselves. So you didn't have this creating these generations of slavery, and that's a huge difference right there. And makes a huge difference in how it's remembered, because you don't have these huge populations, you know, like we do here. But I'm really wrestling right now with this whole idea of what liberty meant, and were people really thinking about it in the same way, and how that works.
And how the language and, I guess, the culture works as
right.
well. And you don't like to compare histories or countries or regions, but have we dealt differently than with slavery in this country? As you said, we fought a war over it.
Right.
We passed, you know, amendments to the Constitution to abolish slavery.
Yeah.
Have we been more proactive dealing with our legacy of slavery, or is it just different country, different history, different culture, different reaction?
Well, there's that, but
yes.
There's definitely that. But, you know, I teach in the history department and in the Department of Africana Studies. And so, and this is one of the things I really like about teaching in Africana Studies, is that I can look at this, and I have students who want to think about this very, very carefully. I think we are nervous here about narratives, too. I think that the memory of slavery is very tricky for us as well. I think it's a minefield. If you look at the different responses to movies that have come out recently, like Django and The Help a year or two ago, I think that there is a way that people talk about it by themselves. I think that there are ways in which it becomes difficult sometimes in certain kinds of mixed audiences. Mm-hmm. We've been doing it for a long time publicly. And I think a lot of that has to do with civil rights and the civil rights movement effect on education. That is not the case in the Middle East. It's talked mm-hmm. about very differently, although that's changing. So, for instance, the Caucasus is not the Middle East, but the Caucasus has a long history of enslavement. And people are talking about it more and more there, also reflected in immigration patterns as well. I think, in Turkey now, there is a group of people who are African-descended people from African slaves who call themselves Afro-Turks and are asserting their identity proudly as sort of trying to, you know, but yes, there are big differences in how we publicly talk about this.
Do you think this has anything to do with the Arab Spring? I mean, do you think they're embedded in that? Is some of this legacy, some of this history? Or is it too soon to tell?
Maybe? I think it's too soon to tell. I think there's a lot too soon to tell about these revolutions going on in the Arab world and Africa.
In Africa
yeah,
as well. Because I think
well.
We often forget about
That's
Middle
right.
East and Africa. We
That's
kind
right.
of lump them all together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, our guest is Eve Trout Powell. She teaches the history of the modern Middle East as an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, where she also teaches in the Africana Department. And back in 2003, she won one of those Genius MacArthur Awards and used her award to do some research for this book that we've been talking about. And the book is titled Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. She's also the author of several other books, and we will continue our conversation. Also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Touched on many things in this hour of radio time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
St. Joseph's University supports WHYY and shares its commitment to a better informed public. Through academics, social justice programs, and real-world experience, SJU is committed to inspiring students to develop their talents and give back to the world around them. More information about St. Joseph's undergraduate, graduate, and degree completion programs is available at sju.edu/livegreater. St. Joseph's University. Live greater. That's the Magis.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the very first day, the very first few hours of the winter membership campaign here at WHYY. That's when we remind you that since you listen to WHYY and you're listening to Radio Times right now, you owe it to yourself to become a member. You decide what the service is worth and then make a phone call. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. And you can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Radio Times provides in-depth interviews on local, national, and international issues, and we introduce you to interesting people and ideas. Today, we're debating and discussing proposals to overhaul the country's immigration system, an important issue in the news today, and talking with Eve Trout Powell about her new book, Tell This in My Memory. Radio Times hosts 2 hours of interviews a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Make a pledge, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Eve Trout Powell. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I'd love to have you read another section from this book where we're introduced to a woman whose name is?
Hoda Sharawi. Okay. And Hoda Sharawi is a very important woman in Egyptian history. She was the founder of the Egyptian women's movement and a real nationalist leader and politician in her day. And this is from her memoirs. I used to imagine that I was not my mother's daughter, that my real mother was a slave girl who had died, and the truth was being withheld from me. Firmly convinced of this, I suffered all the more. I could keep everything suppressed until nightfall, but as soon as I laid my head on the pillow, I was overcome by anxieties and frightening thoughts moved me to tears.
That's so interesting to have this fantasy, imagining being the daughter of a slave girl.
Yeah.
What does that tell us about her?
Well, she grew up in a household where she was an extremely wealthy person, and she grew up in a household where there were slaves all over the place. It was a real multi-ethnic, polyglot group of primarily women, but also men, who served in the great household of Mohammed Sultan Pasha, her dad. And part of the work I tried to do in this chapter is there's a lot of mysteries about her mother, who was herself a very intuitive and insightful woman, Iqbal, but who was probably a concubine,
wow,
which meant that she was purchased. And that never really comes out. But, you know, Hoda kind of, she's whispers about it, but later in the narrative, I mean, she is completely indebted for her imagination, for her ability to think, to the stories that slaves told her, although she can't remember those stories themselves. She at least does cite them in terms of her intellectual growth.
It's so interesting that there's all this history and these family stories and a level of, I don't know if it's denial exactly, but it's not talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of roiling under the waters, but it's not acknowledged or recognized.
I'm not sure what good it would have done Hoda to have that, you know, seriously, because she was really pushing at the edges of marriage, of all kinds of things. But I know that
there's slavery today. I mean, certainly there's slavery in parts of Europe, parts of Africa, I think in the United States as well.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think of today's slavery?
You know, I am deeply curious about it, and I look at websites like iabolish.org, and you know, as I said, I think that Sudan and South Sudan's history is totally pulled in by slavery and the history of slavery. I worry sometimes, though, that we oversimplify some of these stories. I was very concerned in the whole campaign about Darfur and Save Darfur with the comparisons to slavery. I thought that there was a flattening out of the experience of Darfuris there that worried me and took away their voices. And I worry sometimes that How does abolition sound different now than it did in the 19th century? It seems like the tropes are still the same, and I'm not so sure how successful that is. But I'm a historian; I'm not a policymaker, so you know.
But what you're telling us, looking at this part of the world at this period of time, was that slavery was complicated. I mean, to use a very oversimplified word.
Right.
And should we think of slavery today as complicated as well?
Of course. Absolutely. We should. It's so overwhelming, though, the fact that it continues to this day, that it's so overwhelming. How and where does it come from? And
yes.
Where does it, how do you get at these networks that are no longer state-sanctioned, you know, which makes it that much harder, you know? It's
And the buying and selling of human beings is just so offensive. Let me get some callers in, and we have, looks like Firas from Wynwood joining us on Radio Times. And go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I have a comment. I'm originally from Iraq, but I did spend 1 year in Sudan between 95 and 96. And what struck me is that, you know, although, and I'm talking about countries where I lived in and people that I'm acquainted with, there seems to be somewhat of a intolerance, if you will, of people with darker skin. And you know, to piggyback on a point that you mentioned, that we don't see this here in the United States, but we see it a lot in countries where there is not a really mention of a black population. But even within the Sudanese population, there is quite a bit of discrimination, and that's based on the shade of their color as well as their facial features. And it sounded like the, you know, even if you're two people of the same exact color, but you have more African facial features, that you were really discriminated upon. And that word, abid, is used by the person who has the same exact color.
Well, that's interesting.
So just curious to hear if that's something you ran into.
I appreciate the call, Firas, and go ahead.
Oh, I really appreciate your call also, sir. And that is something that I ran into. And it was... I have been at meetings of Sudanese historical meetings in which sometimes the comments about sort of what South Sudanese people are have just hurt. Just amazing, the depth of what you're talking about, these kind of sensitivities that to outsiders look crazy, you know, but they're deeply felt and deeply held judgments and beliefs. And one of the people who helped me a great deal with my first book is a relative of the former Prime Minister of Sudan, Sadiq al-Mahdi, and this was his cousin, who was a wonderful person. And he was dark-skinned, and he would sit there with me and say, "Well, no, this is what you'd look for, and this is what, you know, and this is the difference, and this is the difference." And my cousin came to visit from Detroit. I have a lot of family in Detroit.
Yeah.
And my cousin and he were the same complexion. And my cousin, "What are you talking about?" And we got into this whole thing. I mean, I have to tell you, it did something to my own sense of identity. I'm African-American. I'm biracial. And hearing Sudanese people call me white blew me away. I mean, thank God for Barack Obama. Now I have some precedent in the Middle East. But yes, you're absolutely right. There is that. And thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, Firas, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But you also said that in Egypt, at least in this cab ride, the cabbie probably thought you were Egyptian and not biracial or not African American.
Right. I didn't give him my whole biography.
You had to get the heck out of there. But we do make judgments in this country, don't we? About skin color and features
and
complexion and all that.
Yeah.
I do want to get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. This is a weird segue, but I know that you've talked about the movie The Help. You mentioned that earlier. We were actually talking about Django before the show began. Since we've been talking about slavery, how do you see The Help? How does that fit into our conversation?
When The Help came out... There were the Association of Black Women Historians issued a statement protesting the oversimplification of the roles of the black domestic workers in the film. And really, they didn't criticize Viola Davis herself, the star, but they did say that this was a really careless representation of, like, mammy characters, you know, from Gone with the Wind, and you know, just did not really honor the eloquence of black domestic workers in the early 60s, nor did it really honor their experience, their vulnerability to rape and sexual harassment, the discrimination. I mean, the help talks about the discrimination. So a part of me, the professional part of me, was very moved by that, you know, and I think that that's absolutely true. The other part of me, that is the daughter and granddaughter and niece of women who all worked as domestic workers, well, my cousin told me if I didn't go see the movie, she was going to disown me. And so I went to see the movie, yeah. And I was very, very struck. I went in Manayunk at Main Street, and it was during the day, so it was senior discounts. There were a lot of older people in the room. And people stood up. The audience was 90% black, and people gave that film a standing ovation.
That's interesting.
But on the other hand, so in some ways, it asked people to look at their own help, but it just, why did the narrative have to be through the editing of the white young woman character, the journalist, mm-hmm. instead of just have those women write their stories.
Right, they didn't need someone else to tell their
That's
story.
That's right. And I think the link here to this kind of slavery is we are still nervous about narratives in yeah. this country, that this idea that slaves were able to eloquently tell their stories has never been one that sat comfortably. On the WHYY is showing the abolitionists
yes,
these days.
Yes.
And that whole question about Frederick Douglass's voice has haunted him since he first opened his mouth. So that's where I see right. the help as being useful in sort of reaching across these oceans of language and experience.
But the importance of people telling their own stories.
Right.
Let me get, looks like Khalil from, let's get Khalil to join us on Radio Times. And Khalil, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hey there.
You know, I agree with the, yes, hi.
Hi.
I agree with the speaker of this, that the word abid is used especially by, you know, Arabs in the Middle East to describe more often the color, although there is a word in Arabic for black, which mm-hmm. is aswad, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. but most of, especially uneducated people, they use abid mm-hmm. to describe the color without, mm-hmm. you know, having a racist intention or anything like that. I'll give you one example, you know. My mom, you know, when she came to visit me here in the United States, she said, you know, this area, you know, like in West Philly, it's full of abid. And I stopped her and I said, you shouldn't use that. And she asked why. You know, I said, because abid means slaves. And when you explain it to him, and my mom is very, you know, Islamic devoted and religious person, you know, when I explained to her that the first, you know, Muazzin in Islam was a free slave, Bilal, who was a very famous figure in Islam, you know, very respectful. And the Prophet Muhammad never called him Abid or, you know, he called him Asmab as being, like, nice to him even, you know. And since then, she stopped using this word.
Well, that's interesting.
I have to say, it's been used here a lot, even by Arab Americans in the United States. And especially by people that they don't, you know, pay attention what does this word mean. You know?
Well, Khalil, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Eva, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, Khalil, thank you so much for sharing that personal experience. And it must have been such an interesting encounter with your mom, you know, and how this word translates and doesn't translate. And so I really appreciate that you're bringing that up. I would say that sometimes people in the Arab world use that term and they don't think that it has a certain connotation, but people who hear that word hear it differently. And I think you know that. You've noticed that, and that's why it's so important that you called and said what you just said.
Yeah, Khalil, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Our guest is Eve Trout-Powell. Her book is Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. I'm Ardy Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Wynn from, looks like Westchester to join us. And Wynn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
As an historian, I wonder if your guest would make a link, which I think exists, between the ancient Greeks and their structure within their society of slavery from the colonies, the lands that they took over, and colonized, because it's the same region. Do you think we can blame this all somehow on the Greeks, or at least take it back to them? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Wynne. Is it all the Greeks' fault, Eve? That would be so simple, wouldn't
it? I know.
It?
I usually blame other people, not the Greeks. I have not really ever thought of it like that. I've always made the linkage, not from those territories, but sort of the system of slavery that was impacted by the coming of Islam, and sort of how the different changes in Islamic practices of slavery and changing interpretations of Islamic law and slavery. So I wouldn't begin it. I personally would not begin it with the Greeks. I would take it later, because the system of the legal system surrounding pre-existing trade changed so much over time. And I'm also very hesitant, to do 1,000 years projections of slavery, if you'll forgive me for that hesitancy.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. I know this goes back about, 10 years, I guess, when you were named a MacArthur Genius Foundation Fellow. What does it mean to be called a genius? Do people do it? Do your friends do it in jest, and others do it more respectfully?
My friends know better.
They know better.
Kids know better. it was such a lovely honor, and what was delightful that year was that I was one of four African American women. Or African women who won, and I was then teaching at the University of Georgia, and UGA had never had anybody win a MacArthur, but also it really gave me a sense of confidence that the direction in which my work was going was important and something that people would read and listen to, and that's been.
And allowed you to do the work.
And allowed me to do the work. It gave me so many opportunities. Yeah.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us
pleasure,
today
Marty.
On Radio Times. And again, our guest has been Eve Trout Powell. The book is Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. And again, she teaches the history of the modern Middle East as an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And to learn more about Radio Times, including information about Facebook, Twitter, email, the archives, podcasts, satellite radio, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. That's whyy.org/radiotimes. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Heather Bromfield, our intern. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.